Good afternoon. Thanks for sticking around for our class hour. And this will be our final installment of this particular study. So we'll wrap it up today. And I hope it's been helpful and useful to you. Thinking about creation, Genesis 1. Well, let's start with prayer and we'll go from there. Let's pray. Lord, we thank you for your word, which is truth and is a light unto our path. And we always cherish such times when we can look to your word together. And we thank you for this time. You are a good and mighty creator, God. And as we have pondered your great work of creation, we have been humbled. And Father, we thank you that you have revealed such things to us that we might know, that we might know you and know you through your works and through your word. And so we come with that thanksgiving in our hearts, and we pray that you would bless our time together, that it will be a good one and a fruitful one in terms of our knowledge of you, and particularly that you would be glorified in our midst. We pray in Jesus' name. Amen. Okay, one last thing in relation to last week's study. We were talking last week about dominion, the dominion that man has over animals. That's one of the things that we have discussed. And what that dominion looks like, what it means, and that order that God has established between men and animals. And we were also talking about the idolatrous impulse that arises in man's heart to reverse that order, to worship the creature instead of the creator, as Paul says in Romans 1. And as Exhibit A, we looked at the ancient tendency to make idols in the form of animals, even to worship animals themselves, like the golden calf, for instance, in the Bible from Exodus 32. And all the other examples, archaeologically speaking, of the idols that we have, they're always in the form of an animal, which is interesting. You would wonder why it would be so, but that's the idolatrous impulse of the heart to reverse that order of creation of man having dominion over the creatures. And we noted, too, that idolatry is still among us, and idolaters are more sophisticated, and idolatry is more subtle, but it's still among us. And that one of the ways this is manifest among us is in the animal rights movement and how people afford greater and greater value to animal life and lesser value to human life. And we had just been discussing that last week, and I came across an article, actually two articles, in yesterday's Tribune Review, Saturday, that I thought I would point out because it illustrated what I was talking about just perfectly. I was kind of grasping for examples, you know, of how this comes to pass. But there are two articles on the same page, and it just struck me as such a contrast and such an example of what we were talking about. First of all, it was a cat that had the first ever artificial knee transplant. A cat had a fake knee put in, a transplant of a fake knee. And this cat is 10 years old. He's enormously overweight. It's like 20 pounds because it's overfed and pampered, you know, that kind of cat that lays around the house all day and eats. And so they couldn't amputate the leg. They had to, because the cat's so fat, he can't get around on three legs, so they had to replace it, right? So the operation cost $20,000, okay, for this knee replacement on this cat. And they have a quotation by the owner. Listen to this. it says, the bill to the owners was around $20,000. And it says, then it talks, here's a quote by the owner, sitting in the waiting room after the surgery, talks, they're visibly exhausted and so on. And this is what the owner said about the cat. He's my child. And if it were your child, would you begrudge the money? She said, I have a personal philosophy that people are, at best, equal with the other inhabitants of the planet. And I'm very, very grateful that I have the money and I'm able to do it. So this cat is my child. You hear people talk like that, too, don't you? This is my child, my member of the family, whatever. And other people, it's her personal belief that, you know, people at their best, she said. Yes. People are at best equal with the other inhabitants of the planet. So in our finest form, we're equal to Fluffy here. But that's just an example of what we're talking about. That subtlety of thought, which is not so subtle in an example like this, that raising the value of animal life and lowering at the same time the value of human life, which we also see all around us too in various ways. On the same page, strikingly, there's a smaller article about a man in Oregon who is having charges pressed against him. The police have arrested him and they are pressing charges against him because there was a bear in his garbage can and he tried to scare it away with a pellet gun. He didn't shoot at it with a high-powered rifle to kill it or anything. He shot it with a pellet gun to scare it away, and he was arrested on charges of animal cruelty. By trying to scare a bear away out of the garbage can by shooting it with a pellet gun. I mean, my brothers and I used to shoot each other with pellet guns when we were kids. And now you get thrown in jail for shooting at a bear with a pellet gun. That, to me, was just an example of what we were talking about last week. And some of these things are humorous, too, but I think there's also a very serious issue that underlies all of that. It's a challenge to the gospel. It's a challenge to the basic relationship that God has established between people and animals. And that's being challenged, just like the basic relationship between husband and wife. And so on. Some of these basic relationships established at creation, marriage, dominion over animals and things like that, those are exactly the things that will be sort of reversed or overturned or questioned by the unbelieving world. And so this is one example of that. So anyway, that's just to conclude that discussion that we had last week. Any thoughts or comments on that? No? Okay. Okay, well, today, this is going to be our last study, and so we are on the end of Genesis 1, and we're going to talk today about the seventh day, the institution of the Sabbath day, which meets us at the very end of Genesis 1 and the beginning, the beginning of chapter 2 in Genesis. And obviously, time is a limitation. We're not going to have a chance to, by any means, cover the whole subject of or the doctrine of the Sabbath day. We're not going to look really anywhere else and think about it in the broader biblical terms. But what we're going to do is just look at this text, the seventh day here in Genesis 2, and see what we can see from this text and this text alone. We'll limit ourselves to that. But it's very rich. It's very full. Think about it. Many of the studies of like the Sabbath, the doctrine of the Sabbath, they'll start here out of a sense of duty, but they won't really dig into this text itself exegetically because there's so much here where the doctrine of the Sabbath day begins. I mean, this is the first Sabbath. So in what time we have anyway, we'll just keep our attention focused tightly on Genesis 2 here. Okay, with the end of Genesis 1, the very last verse is, "Then God saw everything that he had made, and indeed it was very good. So the evening and the morning were the sixth day." So God's actual work of creation is completed at this point, and everything is declared very good. We had seen that pattern established throughout the text, that God saw that it was good, it was good, it was good. And now finally, it's very good. That adverb is added onto there, that it's not just good, it's very good. In view of its completion, in view of the totality and the harmony of the whole, now it's very good at the end of Genesis 1. And so that brings us up to chapter 2. And let's read just the first few verses here. "Thus the heavens and the earth and all the host of them were finished. And on the seventh day, God ended his work, which he had done. And he rested on the seventh day from all his work, which he had done. And then God blessed the seventh day and sanctified it, because in it he rested from all his work, which God had created and made." Those three verses we'll focus on today for a little while. Obviously, when we come to this day, the first thing that it says that God did was that he rested. Now, we know, obviously, that God is not a person that he should be fatigued, that he should need a break from all of his labors the way that you and I would need a break. So what could it possibly mean that God rested? What do you suppose it means that God rested? He didn't take a break from his work because he was tired. But OK, but what does it mean? George? He what now? That's a very good answer. He stopped to contemplate what
the creation, what he had done, the very goodness of it.
Okay.
Just throughout this whole narrative, he's doing something each day. And on the seventh day, there is no mention of any creative act.
Yeah.
And then he rested. What is the first thing that spirit that doesn't need rest is doing resting? My guess is that he's checking out.
Yes. Okay, I think that's a good answer, that he stopped. He ceased from his work in order to appreciate and to enjoy that which he had done. We've seen that in intervals throughout the whole creation process where he saw that it was good, you know, and that indicates a pause, an appreciative pause in his own creative work where he notices and rejoices in the goodness of what he's doing. And I think that happens here at the end as well. On the seventh day, he ceases. And you're right. It's not a rest in terms of I'm tired, I need to rest. But actually, the verb Shabbat, from which comes the noun Sabbath, it's a verb, first of all, as it is here. It means to cease. And it has a very positive connotation in the Bible. Again, not in the sense of I'm really tired and I need to rest, that kind of thing. But the positive connotation of completion, of something being done, of the cessation of work because something is being completed. It has been completed. And here I think, as George had said in his answer, that I think that is what's going on. God is ceasing his work here in joy and satisfaction. Now, that's what he's doing. His work has come to an end, and so he ceased working. That note of joy that you mentioned, too, I think is very warranted here. We had looked at on and off Psalm 104. And I'm so impressed with this psalm because it's a magnificent and poetic take on the creation account. And it goes through the days and what God had done on each day. But it has not just the narrative style of Genesis 1, but now a poetic style in Psalm 104. It's a wonderful psalm. And it goes through all the 6 days of creation and everything that God had done. And then at the end of the psalm, right at the end of the psalm, where we would now be at the seventh day, where God rested and the other works have been done, what does it say? It says in verse 31, "May the glory of the Lord endure forever. May the Lord rejoice in his works." That's at the end of the psalm, right where day seven would be. And I think it indicates God's taking joy and pleasure in the completion of his work whenever he ceased from all his work of creation. And then the end of the psalm, too, 33, 34, 35, those verses, again, 6 days of creation, and then may God rejoice in his work. And then the psalmist ends with his own worship and praise. "I will sing to the Lord as long as I live. I will sing praise to my God while I have my being." As if this is a very natural place for him to insert his worship now, on this, at the end where the seventh day would have been when the work is complete. God is rejoicing in his work, and the psalmist is too. So I think that's an interesting thing to see in comparison to Genesis 1 and 2, how Psalm 104 puts it. So I think Psalm 104 might give us a little bit of a clue into what God's cessation or rest is in Genesis 2. And that is a pause to once again note the goodness of his work and to cease from his labors. So this is a rest of achievement, a rest of completion, not a rest of inactivity. And I think what we should compare it to is another great example that comes much later on in redemptive history in the New Testament. When Jesus is done with his work, when his work is complete, what happens after the resurrection and the ascension? What does he do? He sits down at the right hand of God. And this is called his session. Session means to sit in a posture of judgment. And this is referred to as session. Now, is that just a inactivity? He's not just resting from his work, but he is now sitting to actively rule over and to actively dispense the benefits of his work and what he has done, and to rule over the kingdoms that he has won for himself as the mediatorial king. So I think there's a good comparison between those things. The cessation of work means now enjoying its fullness and ruling over it in a sense, just as Jesus did after his work was done. So that's one way to think about the rest that God takes here in this passage. Now, it says he blessed the seventh day. Now, unlike verses 22 and 28 earlier in the text, where God blesses the animals, be fruitful and multiply, and people with the same blessing, be fruitful and multiply, and also the blessing of dominion. This particular blessing here, those are specific and material blessings, but this one is not. This one is a little less distinct, isn't it? It just says he blessed it. He blessed the day. It doesn't go into details for us. So let's try to think it through. How can a day be blessed? And what does a blessed day look like? How does it look different than a different day? It's an interesting question to ponder. But here God is blessing a delineated time period, the seventh day, and a day that holds in itself a blessing, time that is blessed. That's an interesting notion, isn't it? Time that is blessed. Time that is therefore blessed to a different purpose than other time. That's an interesting thing to think about. Now, earlier on, we talked about blessing. We talked about what it meant to be blessed when God blessed the creatures and mankind. And we said, if you remember, that blessings in and of themselves contain two things, a benefit and a purpose. Remember, we talked about God's blessing on the creatures and man. It's a benefit conferred, but it's also a purpose that's given. Here's your purpose. Here's your what you're supposed to be doing, what you're set out to accomplish, a benefit and a purpose. Okay. So let's think of the seventh day here in terms of those things. God's blessing, benefit and a purpose. The benefit of the day, the purpose of the day. Now, who is it for, really? The blessing is for who? For what? I mean, is it just the day itself that's being blessed? Or who is in view of the blessing? Is it a day for God? And yes, in a sense, it is. It's a memorial to the cessation of his work. But be mindful of what Jesus said later in the New Testament, that the Sabbath was made for man, not man for the Sabbath. Now, think about everything else that God has made in days 1 through 6, how he has made these things for man. That everything that God has made to complete the world, he's created it as a perfect habitat and home for man that we can use, and the resources and the animal and everything. We've talked about that. These things are made for our benefit. The Sabbath day, too, is made not for itself, not as a day to be blessed unto itself, but for man. Okay, so let's think about it, not only from what Jesus said, but also everything else in creation points toward that. That God is creating and crafting a world in its totality in which man can flourish. And so that each element of the creation somehow contributes to his ability to flourish as an image bearer of God in this place. And the Sabbath day is part of that. Part of that provision, okay, made for man. So, God creates time and creates days as an aspect of creation, as part of the creation, for the benefit of creation. And the seventh day is part of that, part of its structure and design, part of its completion, and part of the benefits that God has placed here for us. And besides that, we can also see that the Sabbath is created just after the creation of man. At the end of the sixth day, he created the beast, he created man. God saw everything that he had made, and then God blessed the seventh day. So right on the heels of the creation of man should give us some indication that, yes, this is meant for, in some ways, in most ways, and in a big way, the benefit of man. And so everything is very good. Man is created. God is resting from his work. And the Sabbath day then becomes the finishing touch on a world that is created for us. The world would not quite be as habitable for us or as well suited to us without the Sabbath day. But it is the finishing touch on a world created for man to according to our natures and our needs. And the Sabbath day is the finishing touch on a world that is created for us. So this blessing that God pronounces on this day is not just given to the day. It's not as though this would be a perpetually blessed day, whether man was never created or not. That's not the point. The blessing ultimately has man in view, because man is the beneficiary of it, and it's made with his needs in mind. So that blessing is relation to man for his benefit and his purpose. So besides all of the physical provisions that God had and resources that God had made for us the first 6 days, this is the spiritual resource that God has built into creation, built into time itself for the benefit of man. Okay, so he blessed the seventh day, and then it says he sanctified it. That is to say, he made it holy. This is the first occurrence of this very important word, very important concept in the Bible. This is the first time it occurs. This is the way we are introduced to the concept and the word of holiness right here in connection with the blessing and sanctification of the Sabbath day. All right, let me ask you, what does holy mean? Definition is the purest form of knowledge. So give me a definition. What is holiness? What is it? Go ahead.
Set apart. Set apart.
Okay. All right. Set apart. Set apart from what?
Everything
else. Okay, set apart from what is common, what is ordinary. But set apart from all of that, and I would add a little bit to your definition, which is good. Set apart to God's purposes. Now, in a sense, everything is set apart to God's purpose. In a sense, nothing exists that's outside of God's purposes. But it is to be set apart and distinct and in a state of purity for the purpose of a specific dedication to God. In that kind of, in that way. Now, also, holiness, is the preeminent attribute of God spoken of in the Bible. The angels, the seraphim around his throne, the holy, 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 that is his preeminent attribute. But as an adjective, if something is holy, if something is made holy, but if something is described as holy, it is very consistently in the Bible, it denotes nearness to God. God is holiness. I mean, he is holy, holy, holy. The nearer one is to God in spirit and even physically in the Old Testament, the nearer one is to God, those are the more holy something is. Think about in the tabernacle, in the temple, the holy of holies, the most holy place. Why was it so holy? Because it was the closest place to God, where God said that he would dwell. Now, God is everywhere. Remember what Solomon said, the heaven of heavens can't contain you. Everyone understood that. But this is where God said he would be, where he would dwell among his people in a real manifest way. And the closer you got to that, the holier it was. When you went into the holy place, it was why? Because that was a place where God was said that he would dwell with and among his people. So it denotes nearness to God, doesn't it? God possesses absolute holiness. And to be near to him is to be holy. And to approach him is a way of describing holiness, to be closer to him spiritually and also in some ways physically. Now, it's very interesting to note that in the beginning, in the created world, there is no holy place. Instead, there is holy time. No holy place, but only holy time. Okay? So think of it this way. Creation's sanctuary is not a building and it's not a place. It's a day built into time itself. All right? That is the day in which someone would be nearer to God. That nearness to God is not a matter of geography, but God has built his, if you will, a sanctuary into time. So I think the same way that an ancient Israelite would have felt walking into the temple and knowing that this was a holy place and knowing that God had pledged to be there in a specific way, that is what makes it holy. You see, that's the definition of holy. It wouldn't be a holy place if God hadn't pledged to be there, but he did. That's what made it holy. So as the Israelite walked over the threshold of the door into the temple, knowing that he was going into a holy space, how must he have felt? And I think Adam was created to have that same feeling when the seventh day dawned each week. Not when he walked into a place, but when a day came. A holy day. Okay. So the day itself is an invitation and an opportunity to be nearer to and to draw near to the Creator. That's what holiness is all about. So if God makes this day holy, you know that's what it has to be about. And indeed, that's what it is about. So this quality of the Sabbath really makes it a suitable blessing to all men and in all ages. Because holy space is very limiting, isn't it? Holy space is not always accessible. That's why the pilgrims in ancient Israel had 3 days a year when they got to hike up to Jerusalem for the three high holy days. They couldn't always be in that holy place. It's not accessible unless you live in Jerusalem, unless you're a priest. So it makes it difficult, doesn't it? It's not accessible. It's only in one place. But holy time, you see, is accessible to all, anywhere, because you don't have to be somewhere geographically. You wait and the day comes to you. You don't have to go to a place. And that's why the idea of a holy day is so well suited, first of all, to the true religion, which is never ultimately confined to an ethnic group or a geographical location. Many false religions are. This is our religion, that's your religion, and this is our place, and that's your place. Think about the woman that Jesus spoke to. You said this mountain, we said this mountain. Okay. False religions have that as a common quality. But a Sabbath day, and this is unique now to the true religion, to have a holy day makes it accessible to all and in all places. There are no limiting factors. So, this is what makes the institution of the Sabbath so preeminently suitable to the true religion, a worldwide religion, and the New Testament expression of this religion too. Because if there were just one holy place, we would never be there. I wouldn't want, you know, you'd have to take a trip to Israel every three times a year or something. Think about the whole idea of pilgrimages, what the Muslims do. Again, the idea of holy place, limited. You have to go to it, but the Sabbath day comes to you. So it's suited to the New Testament church era as well, because we are in the holy day right now. We didn't have to go anywhere. It came to us. OK, so that's a very important thing. So our sanctuary is a day. It's not a place. And that's why we have to get our terminology and our thinking right. When we call Sunday, it just makes it like any other day. I think we really should call it the Lord's Day or the Sabbath day, or the Christian Sabbath. One of those things, because it reminds us it's a sanctified day, it's a holy day. And this place we should never call a sanctuary, because it's not. It's not a holy place. It's just a room. It's a nice big room. It suits us for what we do here, but it's not a holy place. But we are in the holy day. So that's something to bear in mind and a distinction to make very clear. So the day matters much more than the place. In fact, the place doesn't matter at all. Jesus taught us that. But the day does. So think of it this way. A holy day is like a sanctuary built into time. And as such, it is an invitation to draw near to God and to commune with Him. An invitation that is built into time and that is accessible to all. So it's really suitable as a creation ordinance, isn't it? It's a fascinating thing to see. Okay. Now, in terms of the seventh day itself, verses 1, 2, 3 of chapter 2. Something's missing on the seventh day. And that is, all the other days have, in the evening and the morning, were the first day, the second day, the third day, the fourth day. Because the whole account here is moved by two different patterns. God saw that it was good, and the evening and the morning. God saw that it was good. The evening and morning were the next day. God saw that it was good. Those are the two patterns that move the narrative, right? Now, we already saw how the one pattern was broken. God saw it was good, 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 very good. The other pattern's broken too, at the same point. And that is evening and morning, evening and morning, evening and morning, up to six, and then just the Sabbath day, the seventh day. And there is no evening and morning. for the seventh day. Now, interestingly enough, a lot of patterns take place. It's a literary device in the Hebrew Bible, and you get them in different forms. And interestingly enough, to have a break in the pattern is a purposeful way to draw the eye towards something, to fix a focal point in that pattern whenever there's a missing link in the chain or a broken pattern. And I think that's what's happening here as well. There's no evening and morning for the seventh day. God just blesses it, sanctifies it, and that's that. Now, we can surmise that there was an evening and morning, but the text really purposefully leaves us with the impression of a day unbounded by evening and morning. It doesn't follow that pattern for the seventh day. And I think it's because the dimensions of the day and what it stands for, what it really is, are yet to be discovered, are yet to be brought out in their fullness by the scriptures. That will be developed, what the true dimensions of this day are and what its true significance is. J.G. Voss called this quality of the text the infinite perspective of the seventh day, even the first seventh day here. And so there is, I think, this is a signal by the text that there's more to be discovered about this day and its significance. But we do discover, just briefly put, what this text only hints at, and that the infinite perspective without the evening and morning really does end with its fulfillment in statements that relate eternity to us as being a sort of Sabbath rest. Think especially of Hebrews 4, where it talks about the Sabbath day and God entered his rest and so on. And then it builds the whole argument. The conclusion is there's a rest yet for us to go to, and that is the eternal rest of ceasing from our works when we finally enter into the rest of God. So the writer of Hebrews in chapter 4 makes this connection very clearly. The Sabbath day is a type of, an example of, an eternity of rest with God. And so there's just maybe a little hint of that in the text here. Whenever we see a day without evening and without morning. Okay. Now, we have a pattern established of 6 days of work and one Sabbath, resulting in a seven-day week. And so each week itself is one self-contained unit, an entire lesson about the works of God and the consummation that is to come, capped off by holy time of a sanctified day. So each week presents to us that total pattern. That first creation week is a very typical thing. If the seventh day is, in a sense, typified the eternity of rest with God, then the first 6 days typify his work and then his rest, the space of all of God's doings and then the consummation. So each week contains in miniature, a reminder of that. Now, consider this one point. Interestingly enough, a week is the only measure of time that is based entirely upon and directly upon the work of God. All of the other measures of time that you can think of, a day, a month, seasons, years, all of them are based on what? Phases of the moon, movements of the sun, movements of the stars. In fact, back on day 4, whenever God created all the sun and the moon and the stars and everything, he said, so that it will be 4 days and years and seasons. But a week, what is a week based on? It doesn't change with the movement of any heavenly bodies, moon, stars, sun. It doesn't matter. A week is a week. And regardless of what the heavenly bodies are doing. So a week stands out as a pattern directly fashioned from the work of God himself, and the appointment of the Sabbath day is what completes that week and completes that pattern. I think that's a fascinating to think about. A week is the only thing disconnected from the physical world, with its origin coming directly from a divine example at creation. So the weekly Sabbath reminds us of this, that God is wholly above and beyond and over nature, and that creation is a supernatural work, and that time itself is a creation and a possession of God. So think of each week itself. And I really think weeks are the basic unit of our thinking and of our work, right? We think by week to week and so on. I mean, days are perhaps the most basic unit of that, but weeks, I think, are what in the time frame in which we just live and move and work. And each one of them is a complete lesson of something from beginning to end, and a complete picture of the work of God and the consummation that will come at the end. So I think that's something to think about week to week as we go through life. Okay, I want to talk about verse 3, where it says, "Then God blessed the seventh day and sanctified it, because in it he rested from all his work, which God had created and made." Which he created and made. Now, it might sound needlessly repetitive there, which he created and made. But that English phraseology conceals a pretty unique point in Hebrew, where that very last verb in that sentence is actually an infinitive. And translated by some ancient commentators and so on, as not have made, but to do. It's an infinitive. So think about it this way. God blessed the seventh day and sanctified it, because in it he rested from all his work which God had created to do. Now, technically, that's a literal translation of that last verb, which is an infinitive. Some translations will have all the work which he began to do, trying to take that infinitive as an indication of his ongoing work, which he began to do. And there are actually many different translations of this one little verse. It's interesting. Line them all up, all the English translations. Everybody tries to scramble to do something with that last infinitive, because you got to do something with it. But I tend to go back and look at some obscure commentators, especially medieval Jewish commentators, which are very interesting, by the way. And we tend to overlook them, but they go down into the Hebrew of the text to a depth that most English commentators don't. So you have to appreciate them for that anyway. But anyway, Ibn Ezra and another commentator, David Kimchi, who are medieval Jewish commentators, they both retain the full force of this infinitive as an indication that there is work created for man yet to do, that there is more to do that is now entrusted for man, i.e. all the work that God created to do. Now, the previous verse already talks about what God had done, what he had created in the past tense or the perfect tense. But then this verse, instead of being repetitive, talks about what there is yet to do. Now listen to it all together, verse 2 and 3. "And on the seventh day God ended his work which he had done, and he rested on the seventh day from all his work which he had done. Then God blessed the seventh day and sanctified it, because in it he rested from all his work which God had created to do." So it's he had done, and then he rested from all the work which he created to do. Now, could that be a possible way to read the text? I think so, especially in light of what comes later in verse 5, how it talks about, as of yet there was no man to work to till the ground. That's one of the things that Adam was entrusted with right off the bat. Hey, as soon as it's created, keep that garden, tend it, keep it, and so on. And that's what he's created to work, to till the ground. And really, the fourth commandment in the Ten Commandments is based on creation, that we are supposed to work for 6 days and rest on one and follow that pattern. So there is work to do, right? That's part of the creation. That's part of the fourth commandment, that there are things to be done. Work to do and a Sabbath to keep. So, I think this is a valid way of looking at the text, indicating that what man is called to do, and we've already seen that for his labor, his guarding, his keeping the garden, his dominion, and so on, what he is called to do is an extension of what God has already done and began to do. The first 6 days God created this thing, and now man is placed there, and there's still work yet to do. And God entrusts those things to him. So, that will put our work into perspective, I think. And the text may very well, in that sense, put into view what remains. The fact that the seventh day, this isn't the end of the story. There's much more that is to come. Okay, we're almost out of time, but let me suffer me a final thought here. And the final thought is this. The Sabbath day stands along with marriage as the two institutions of creation. These two things meet us first. This is what first meets the eye to the reader of the Bible. Read chapter 1 and 3 verses into chapter 2, and already you have these two institutions. From the creation of man, the male and the female, for each other, marriage, and you have the Sabbath day. So I think this puts into perspective how both of these things are so foundational to not only mankind and our existence, but creation itself. It is as though now at the end of this 6 days and the seventh day comes and it is blessed and sanctified. Now the process is over. Now we can proceed. Now the world history is ready to begin. Now the story is ready to begin because these two things are in place. The man and the woman, they're together and the Sabbath day is in place. Now it's done. So these two things are so very foundational when we look at Genesis 1 and 2. Now remember this. We talked about how man was made in the image and likeness of God. And part of that is that God wrote his law on the heart of Adam. That Adam knew intuitively how to please God, what to do, how to obey God. That was part of the image and likeness. Now that law that God wrote on Adam's heart was later articulated in the Ten Commandments, specifically. And you remember in the Ten Commandments, too. You have to follow this line of thinking. Follow me through. I know we had lunch and you're tired and everything, but just connect these dots together. God made Adam, put the law on his heart. The law is summarized in Ten Commandments. There are two tables in that law. The first table of the Ten Commandments have to do with the relationship between God and man, the first four of the Ten Commandments. The second table of the law have to do with our relationship between each other, our earthbound relationships, people to people, man to man. Okay. Now, these two institutions that are foundational, that we see at creation, the Sabbath and marriage, they seem to embody those two relationships and those two tablets of the law, don't they? Because the Sabbath is meant to maintain that first relationship and be one of the foundation points of it between God and man. It's one way. It's that little sanctuary built into time where we can approach our Creator. So the Sabbath maintains that relationship between God and man. And marriage. Marriage is the primary earthly relationship, isn't it? Of course, in all of our dealings, there's many relationships. But marriage is the sort of the incipient, the primary relationship, isn't it? And the one without which there would be no other. So it is the primary relationship on earth. So it's quite suitable then, if you think about it. If God wrote that law on Adam's heart, those two tables of the law, that there would be two institutions that kind of embody or represent those two tables of the law that are written on his heart. And the Sabbath and the marriage are both obviously mentioned in the Ten Commandments. There's the Sabbath commandment and also the thou shalt not commit adultery. That is, this sacred institution shouldn't be broken, shouldn't be changed or altered. And both of them that are then found at creation as two primary institutions of the created world. So these two things, the Sabbath and marriage, embody the two primary relationships and the two tables of the law. And later on, even in the scriptures, the Sabbath will be spoken of in terms of a covenant, much like marriage, since there are two relationships that we're dealing with. The Sabbath is much like that. Okay, our time's up, and yes, Tom.
When communists came to power in Russia, they tried to change the week to a period of 10 days as a way of expressing their rejection of the Judeo-Christian tradition. But it collapsed. People could not make the change effectively. I think during the French Revolution, they tried to do something similar, which also collapsed. So it's interesting. Seems to be protection that God has made around the week,
yeah.
Even if the
That's an interesting point to bring out. I hadn't really realized that those Tom was pointing out how various groups during the French Revolution, for once, and the communists in China and Russia attempted to change the week so that there was not a 7-day week but a 10-day week to get away from this pattern that's clearly based on the scriptures. It's interesting. I wonder if there's in the popular mind and thinking, I wonder if we're getting away from the pattern too. We didn't talk about the change of the day. I wish we had another hour. We would, from the seventh day to the first day, because that's a neat study too. But even though the Lord's Day is the first day of the week, I'm always interested to see calendars that always put it at the end of the week. And many of them do. The idea that it's one more day of the weekend rather than the first day of the week. Those subtleties are there, just in people's perceptions. But okay, anything else? All right. Well, let's close with a song. Will we do that, Mark? How about, since we have been singing 104 during our lessons here, let's do that again. Let's sing 104. We've sung D a few times. Is 104C, are we capable of that? Yeah. Can we sing 104? What is it? E. Let's sing E. Can we sing 104E? All right, 104E, and then we'll be dismissed. Let's stand and sing.
E.
I'll sing to the